Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to The Back Half with me, Tom.
And me, Kate.
And we have a special summer episode today to tie in a sort of cross-platform branding exercise. We're tying in with our summer double issue of The New Statesman.
This is the issue that we take months to create every year, panic about, and it's on the shelves for 2 weeks and it's very glossy with lots in it. But then we always finish it early, don't we? We panic and then there's no reason to panic.
But if we didn't panic...
bad things would happen.
Yeah, bad things would happen.
It's a bit like the Christmas issue. It has many pages.
Many, many pages. After the 2 weeks, everyone just forgets about it.
Mm-hmm. No one speaks of it again.
No.
It has to have special properties.
I like to keep it on my desk for months afterwards just to remind me of how much work went into it. Not in that issue, but in another issue of the magazine, possibly, you've written about Paul Simon. You went to see Paul Simon last weekend.
Yes, his farewell show.
Yeah, how was that?
As part of his Homeward Bound tour. I was really shocked when I found out that he was doing a Homeward Bound tour, because the last time I looked, he was literally about 69 years old. Hmm. And now he's 76, because time moves on. And he looks kind of strange at the moment. He's got looks, his colouring is odd. It's kind of strong and grey. He looks like a kind of ghost. With shadows and sort of grey hair. It was very, I've never really done any of these, like going along to final shows of people, because I think in a way it's almost like just like, so you could say you did it.
Yeah.
And this one was different because I had sort of, you know, family and historical tie to him through having listened to him from earliest memories and stuff. So yeah, it was emotional.
I saw him in 2012 when it was an anniversary of Graceland, possibly 25 years.
Yeah.
Hyde Park also. And he played the entirety of Graceland. Did he do much of Graceland?
Yeah, he did Boy in the Bubble, Graceland, a couple of others. He did loads of Rhythm of the Saints. He had, he paced his energy really well. So he, when he started singing, his voice was very wobbly and distant. Mm. And I thought, this is really why it's a farewell tour. And he had a kind of chamber orchestra around him, this New York group called Y Music. So it was literally cellos and violins and woodwind and stuff, but then it sort of swelled out into the 1986 big brass band with the African musicians and stuff, and his voice got stronger and stronger throughout it as well. So that kind of, he was just like saving himself, I think. And then at the end he did this incredible 2 or 3 song acoustic set where he did American Tune, which is obviously his anti-Vietnam song, and it just resonated with Trumpness because it was the day that Trump was leaving his Scottish golf courses, and he didn't need to say anything at all.
To head off to meet Putin.
To meet Putin, there's this idea of a kind of battered nation with a headache, unable to sleep and having bad dreams and stuff. It was just incredible. It felt like everybody was there, and then, you know, the streets were thick with people afterwards and you couldn't get into any of the tubes. And he timed Bridge Over Troubled Water to hit the exact moment the sun went over the horizon. And I was thinking about, I wrote about this a bit, but you know, how much do these farewell gigs actually mean to the artist? Can they really conjure up a sort of relationship with the country in their minds when they're performing, when they're never going to see that stage again and stuff like that? Or is it just, you know, a job?
He's got a bit of a connection with the UK, hasn't he? I'm pretty sure that they did some of the Graceland recording in the UK.
Also, didn't he come here in the 60s and do loads of folk clubs and
yes,
things like that?
Yeah.
He had some early sort of inspiration
from,
which is weird when you think of the Greenwich Village folk clubs, that he actually found something in ours. But yeah, we will not see his like again.
His catalogue is kind of amazing, actually, isn't it? When you, the breadth of it, because you think of Graceland as a sort of discrete entity, but at either end of that, there's so much more.
Yeah. And then in when he was 72, he did this thing called Rewrite, which was he's one of the only people that can get away with being a grumpy old man without it making him sound old.
Yeah.
And he sort of talks about a rewrite on his own life. And there's some poignant line about, I'd like to substitute the bit where the father has a breakdown with a car chase. Kind of thing. So he's just looking back over himself and sort of trying to make it better. And then there's a whole song which he did. The nice thing is it was like, oh, yeah, this is going to be a greatest hits tour, but greatest hits show. But actually it wasn't at all, because he played this song called Wristband, which is literally just about how annoying it is to be asked for a wristband when you're going backstage. And it's like, that really is the most grumpy thing ever written. And he's like, yeah, here's one of my hits. It's like, no, that was not a hit.
Do you think he'll stick to it then? He kind of has to, doesn't he? I mean, when people announce their, I'm always suspicious when novelists say, this is my last novel, or musicians say, this is my last gig, or whatever. I'm always a little bit suspicious.
I guess that he certainly won't retire as a musician, but he doesn't have to do these massive grueling
tours. Yeah.
He's been touring for 50 years. It's unlike Elton John, who obviously earlier this year announced his retirement in 3 years' time. So he's doing 3 years of gigs before he retires, by which time his children are going to be teenagers, because he wants to spend more time with his children. So wait till they're at secondary school.
Dickens died halfway through his farewell tour.
Did he?
Yeah.
How far did he get?
He basically had the equivalent of an arena tour booked, doing readings from, I think maybe I mentioned that, I have to be careful about rolling out.
I think
anecdotes.
We use a lot of
I've
our
only
material.
Got six anecdotes. I've only got six anecdotes, and this is my Dickens one. And even then, I haven't got the details right. When we talked about Christmas Carol in January, just after Christmas. Yes, he did. He had a big farewell tour, but he knew he was ill, but he didn't make it all the way. He had to, the last few gigs a la Michael Jackson were.
Yeah.
The plug was pulled. Sadly.
Sadly.
What else are we going to be talking about in
we
this
are going to be talking about
half. Well
two special properties of the summer issue.
Yeah,
a very interesting feature that you have brought together about collections.
Mm-hmm.
Famous people and famous writers and their surprising collections. And the other thing we're going to speak of is that I interviewed the League of Gentlemen, who are just about to embark on their own, not farewell tour, but maybe farewell tour, an arena tour around the UK. And I demanded that I interview them all separately, which I felt a bit bad about, because they had to come down one by one my room and sit on a plastic chair. But there's nothing worse than interviewing
a group
of people.
There's one waiting outside as the first one went.
Pretty much. And
out.
They also said, what order do you want us in? And I was like, I don't mind. That's like, I'm literally not going to stipulate what order I get you in. But there's nothing worse than interviewing. It's like interviewing a band in a group. It's just awful. It's basically just too pressurizing for the interviewer, and they all show off in front of each other. So we avoided that.
Okay, all of that coming up. So, Kate, you were just saying that you imperiously demanded that each of the four members of the League of Gentlemen come to your office for your 10-minute GP surgery individually. There are only three on screen, aren't they? So what's the dynamic? Who does what?
Jeremy Dyson is the fourth member, the non-acting member, who met Mark Gatiss at... Gatiss was in the second year of Bretton Hall Drama College at that point, and they were introduced by a mutual friend. They were both resistant to the idea of being introduced because the mutual friend had said, you've got to meet this guy, he's just like you. And there's nothing more annoying than that.
But I'm unique.
And they bonded over the fact that they both, within 5 minutes, were recalling a lost John Inman sitcom from the late 70s that ran for one season on Sunday night, and neither of them could remember the name of it. And they thought, okay, I get it. We are exactly the same. And Steve Pemberton and Reese Shearsmith were also at Bretton Hall. And the interesting thing about the way they work is that they work in those pairs. Those are the friendships they were explaining. So Gatiss and Dyson write, and Pemberton and Shearsmith write, and obviously they produced Inside Number 9. Which is people are increasingly saying this is the best show on television, which is lovely because it's one of those sleeper things.
Mm.
I don't even think it was on. It was some weird channel, wasn't it, at first? And then now it's kind of gradually creeping into people's consciousness. Mm.
So they all met. How did League of Gentlemen come? I mean, tell us a bit about the setting and how it originated.
They bonded through shared experiences of what their parents said about their choice of drama as a career.
Right.
So they were all from working class backgrounds. Right. Gacy's parents were of a mining family. His dad was the first of the family not to go underground, but to be a mining engineer. And he's from Sedgefield, Durham, Tony Blair's old constituency. The other two are from Blackburn and Hull. And Jeremy Dyson was in Leeds, I think. So they had this sense of the fact they came from backgrounds that were not Radio 4 backgrounds. They weren't arts-based. They never went to the theatre.
And they just found They weren't footlights.
Yeah. So they just found it amusing that their parents would say, you know, they were going to spend their whole lives on the Dole. And of course, they were on the Dole for many years because it took them about 8 years to get it together. But they got Pauline, the restart officer, out of the Dole experiences. And they got the Legs Akimbo Theatre Company out of the unemployed periods as well. So it's just a classic tale, really, of doing things another way. I mean, I think when they won the Perrier Award in 97, they were the first sketch show to have won it since the Footlights. And they used to wear these ironic tuxedos because people thought that they must be footlightsy. And Gatiss was saying that, you know, it literally was that you'd go, people thought they'd gone to Royston Vasey, their fictional Yorkshire town, as a kind of on a field trip almost to see how these weird northern people live, when of course they were northern themselves.
So I'm sure most of our listeners will probably be familiar with this show, but for those that aren't, Royston Vasey is the setting. This is this fictional northern town. And it's sort of sketches within all within that world.
Yeah, it's a weird kind of dystopian town full of, it was first broadcast in 98, I think, dystopian town full of circus freaks and people who eat human flesh and local butchers and people trapped in terrible marriages and, you know, nasty domestic situations versus impoverishment and dead-end jobs and all that kind of thing. But it always had this kind of grand guignol element to it where it was very over the top. And I was working in Budgeons at the time on my gap year in rural Norfolk, and I just remember seeing the trailers for it in September 1998 and just thinking, this is my show. I'm going to watch this from the start without my parents, because I'm still living at home. This is not something I've inherited from them. This isn't like watching Blackadder, and I'm going to watch this, and this is mine. Because it's something about the idea of the kind of the colourful horror that you can find in sort of wet, dead-end life and rural small-mindedness was sort of what inspired them. And also they looked at the areas that they'd grown up in, and Steve Pemberton was saying to me, as like, we pictured those desolate parks where you used to go and play, and you'd always find a damp porn magazine in a concrete tunnel, and a concrete tunnel was something to play in, and it always stank of piss. And if you've grown up anywhere like that, which I mean, Norfolk is not like that at all, but, you know, hours and hours and hours completely on your own in the countryside with just your mind and your VHSs of strange horror films and versus Indiana Jones and James Bond. I mean, that was what produced this, really. This was four guys from relatively normal working class backgrounds who just watched TV all the time.
They're working from a sort of very English template of slightly kind of gentler comedy like Alan Bennett and Victoria Wood, and just giving it a, I mean, I know Victoria Wood isn't always gentle, or at least there's often a bite underneath it, the gentle veneer, but they're taking that and then giving it a kind of darker twist.
Yeah, the reason I wanted to do this was that they of course came back at Christmas with this kind of three-part special, which I remember when people heard about that, it was like, oh, is this actually going to work? Has it been too long? And it was incredibly successful because they went back to Hadfield in Derbyshire, which is the town that Royston Vasey became, this sort of the fictional, the one that they based it on. And they found it had been gentrified because of the urban regeneration in Manchester. It's about 12 miles from Manchester. And they had to spend money to make the town look crap again.
Yeah.
So all this stuff had changed, but they took at the heart of the show, obviously, there's this very obscure joke about two people who run a local shop who don't want anybody in it. And the slogan is, it came out of the era of catchphrase TV in the 90s. So it was, you know, this is a local shop for local people. There's nothing for you here. Hello, hello, what's all this shouting? There's nothing for you here. And of course, this just played perfectly into the post-Brexit Britain that they found themselves in when they were rewriting this. So there's a lot of political twists in the version that came back at Christmas. But there's also something about the dialogue that was sharper as well. And I actually wrote some of it down. So I was watching the restart officer, Pauline, in the job centre. And she comes in and she's sitting in front of all these tired men who are sort of, you know, unemployed. And she complains of the smell. And she says, Smell that, job seekers. This is the smell of idleness. Dirty little bum cracks pumping out gas from a quick-save no-frills pasty. Eaten cold at 4 a.m. because time has no meaning for you. That is your smell, job seekers. And I am an aerosol. And it was just when you saw it written on the page and how crunchy and condensed and dark and Victoria Wood-esque it was, I thought, this writing has actually translated into the present day. This isn't out of date anymore.
Mm. Had her character or any of the others become nastier or sharper, do you think, in the recent iteration?
I think there was a hell of a lot of darkness to it, because she in the recent one was actually suffering from major dementia, and the setting of her in the job centre was part of something called, I think, a kind of regression therapy that was being done by the National Health Service to try and remind her who she was. So at every turn, they put something horrible
in
it.
An extra layer.
There's a character whose wife has got really fat, he asks his friend to kill her in a mercy killing. You know, it's really, really nasty stuff. There's Tubbs and Edward cut two reporters' faces off at the end of it. So on no account had they held anything back. And they also, what I loved is that they had taken their transvestite character, as I think she was, Barbara, the taxi driver, who was seen going in for an op. So she was like pre-op transsexual by the end of the original series. They'd taken her and they kind of ignored all the political incorrectness around it. And it opens with her saying that her cab is a safe space. And, you know, we're not just laughing matter for the likes of you anymore. And she shuns the acronym LGBT, but she's invented her own, which spells out acronym, which is actively reconsidering gender reassignment or not yet made your mind up. And Gatiss was saying, like, I do think these acronyms are ridiculous. They are absurd. Yeah. And we're not going to stop making jokes about this.
They're very brave to address trans issues, aren't they, on the show? I was thinking about why, because we're in an era in which people take offence perhaps easier than they did 20 years ago. I was thinking about why their characters are not offensive. And I think is it possibly just because they are so well written and they're so odd that they're not like, oh, this character is a straightforward two-dimensional version of a trans person, or this character stands in for an older person living in a rural setting.
Yeah.
Like they're too awkward to be kind of straightforward representations of different social groups.
Yeah, Pemberton said in 97 that we wanted to subvert the traditional sketch show, which, as its name suggests, is not very well filled in. That was a quote from him. And he said, we wanted to make our characters lovable and better written. And with Barbara, for instance, I mean, Shearsmith was saying to me that, you know, she was a very lovable, sweet-natured person. And this was true. Like, right from the start, she was the one that the new arrivals to Royston Vasey could really chat to in the back of the cab. And she's kind of come out of it better than anybody else, in a sense, because she was right all along about the way she chose to live her life, and now the world's caught up with her. So there is that sort of sense of the poignancy to them. And Shearsmith was saying that he finds Ollie Plimsoll's the most poignant character to play, who's now ended up as a drama teacher when he had dreams of, you know, really being a proper theatre writer. And he's written, he's still writing educational plays, including Slipface, which is about burkas, and Suck It and See, which is about revenge porn. And it's like, how do they get away with this? But they do get away with it.
They mentioned to you in your piece about how that local shop for local people, sort of, they kept seeing it crop up in sort of political cartoons and things. And it is interesting how, I mean, now we're obsessed with this, you know, and it gets quoted endlessly, this book written by David Goodhart, which divides everyone into anywheres and somewheres, as in the people who are very rooted to their locality, who are the kind of supposedly the leave voting population, and the people who are a bit more affluent and very comfortable living anywhere and feel more like citizens of the world. It's interesting how Lee kind of tapped into that idea of the somewheres very early on, before it became a thing with a capital T.
Yeah, because the owners of the local shop are extremely posh, like really, really posh kind of RP accents and noses stuck in the air. And there are all sorts of accents mixing in Royston Vasey. There are Durham accents, Welsh ones. There's a kind of bizarre Spanish guy who sounds like Manuel of Fawlty Towers. Yeah. And they, I don't think that their relationship with the idea of being Northern was straightforward at all. I mean, Dyson told me that they couldn't stand Northern comedy, which put it on for the sake of it, but that they themselves were informed by Alan Bennett and Victorian Wood and Les Dawson. So they were actually looking at the North-South divide and looking at what was wrong at Northern attitudes with Northern attitudes, as well as what was great about the North. So yeah, that sense of kind of difference and small-mindedness was at the heart of it, rather than sort of saying we are better than you.
I know you interviewed them separately, but did you get the sense that they still sort of get on, they still mesh? Because Gatiss, they've all gone on to do different things, haven't they? And Gatiss in particular has become, he's a real star, isn't he? I mean, he must be so...
Sherlock,
he's so highly in demand, both
Doctor
as a writer
Who.
And an actor. Yeah,
I mean, you can't really tell with those things, can you? Because it was funny watching them rehearse in inverted commas, because they were literally just standing around a MacBook Air in the deserted bar of the Union Chapel in Islington. And I would love to have been a fly on the wall and actually seen how they get on. It was interesting that they
sorry to interrupt you, but there is one fantastic episode of Inside Number 9 with two comedians when they come to rehearse. And that's when you said you were going to watch them rehearse, that for some reason was what was in my head. It's like in a hall adjacent to a church, isn't it? It's in a church hall, and they've got their kind of bags full of costumes and things.
That's exactly, you kind of expect to see wigs and crazy fake breasts.
Yeah, just a MacBook. Yeah.
But I think they were literally writing it. I mean, I don't get any sense of how it works, apart from that they did all stress that there are these two friendship groups within it, and that's how the writing still gets done now.
Yeah.
And they all said that it was kind of effortless to come back to it, but there was something about, maybe I'm just reading this into it, but I imagine that Gatiss has got so much else to do and to be getting on with, that this is kind of he described it as like playing.
Right.
And no one interferes. Yeah. So he's come back to his earliest writing life, and he's doing a bit more of this, and then he'll probably carry on doing his other things.
I guess, however highly esteemed you are, working on things like Sherlock Holmes and Doctor Who comes with so much baggage that going back to something that you created must actually be a lot of fun. So they're doing a sort of arena tour.
Yeah, it starts
right?
on August the 6th up north, and I think it goes all over the country, and they're presumably quite big venues, but I don't know much about what's going to be on stage because it was all under wraps. So they were writing new material, but obviously you know that you're going to go and get Tubbs and Edward and that lot when you see it.
Kate's piece is in the aforementioned Summer Double issue of The New Statesman.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So Tom, you had an idea for the Summer Double, which was to ask people about their collections or their scrapbooks or their personal kind of interests early in life.
I did have an idea, Kate, and that's something that happens approximately
once a week,
once every 2 or 3 months. And this came from a tweet I had a scrapbook when I was a kid, and I'd found it recently going through some stuff at my parents' house. And it was very like, it's one of those sort of Proustian Madeleine type objects that I've actually got very patchy memory of my entire childhood.
Dark.
Not through any trauma, but just through having a crap memory. That's why I'll never be a novelist, because I don't have total recall of of some important exchange with a primary school teacher, nor can I, like my wife, remember the first and surname of every single person in her primary school class. This scrapbook was a really resonant object to me, and I was looking to get one for my daughter. I mean, the stuff I put in my scrapbook, it was weird, actually. It was stuff cut out from magazines, but it was like, a lot of it was ads cut out from magazines.
What kind of ads?
Like 80s advertising for like Alka-Seltzer, and but like that would have like little cartoon animals as like mascots in it or something. Like people water skiing. I don't know. Yeah.
How old were you when you made this?
Maybe like five.
Wow. Five. You still got it?
Yeah, still got it. Yeah. It's a red one, and it's Sylvine. I don't know if anyone can picture that. It's a brand of stationery, and it's got a very nice little crest on the front. Anyway, I was looking for something like that for my daughter, because she likes cutting things out. I thought she'd be good for her to have a scrapbook. And just the first, I was in a post office and I saw exactly the same scrapbook as I had, the same size, same shapes, everything. So I was really delighted with this. So I bought it, obviously, and took a picture of it and tweeted it and said, you know, it's lovely to find your old scrapbook and give it to your kid. And loads of people chipped in saying, I had one of those. I used to collect this X, Y, and Z. Suzanne Moore said, you know, I had a scrapbook where I just recorded everything about the moon landings. I was completely obsessed. And so that was what made me think that this might make a nice feature. But we expanded it. So it started as a scrapbook idea, but after that became just anything that you collected. And it was interesting how basically everyone who I asked said, well, I'm not really a collector, but, and then and proceeded to talk about some strange and kind of
very strange, obsessive
collection that they put together. They're mainly childhood, obviously, although some of them have gone into adult life. But I think it's something that most people have tried at some point in their life. Did you collect anything?
I only had scrapbooks with pictures of Ralph Fiennes in.
Right.
And then Roger Taylor. So yeah, they were just scrapbooks.
But it's linked with what we'd now call fandom. You know, like, so I think that counts. You know,
I had these two pictures of Ralph Fiennes that I laminated and carried around in the pocket of my school skirt. And one was taken from the programme of an RSC production, which I don't know where I'd got. I think I'd sent off for it from his manager or something like that. And yeah, they fitted into my pocket quite well, unless I had to put anything else in my pocket, in which case they were kind of busting out. But yeah, I think they, because you got some very sort of surprising submissions, didn't you? I mean, David Shrigley's interested me.
David Shrigley collects rulers, or did collect rulers. I thought David Shrigley might collect something. And I weirdly wasn't surprised when he said rulers, but this all happened. I think this happens quite often when he started to get some interest in his work, and he was starting to become more widely known. Journalists would come and interview him, and for some reason, a couple of them asked him, "Did he collect anything?" And sort of on a whim, he said rulers. He's got quite a dry sense of humour, so I think I can imagine him sort of being quietly amused at that. I think he did like rulers.
Has he secretly just got three or something?
Yeah, no, he wasn't. He emphatically was not collecting rulers. But then this somehow became known, and whenever people came to visit him, they would bring him a ruler, which I think he enjoyed for a bit. And he had some nice. He was telling me about this artist that he met in Australia who had made him a ruler, a cast ceramic ruler. 31 centimeter ruler.
Wow.
Which he was really delighted with. And a neighbor whose father he'd known, and the father died, and the neighbor gave David Shrigley their father's collection of engineering rulers, which he said are really beautiful. But then basically he was doing a show in Germany, and it was sponsored by some big multinational corporation. And they said, well, David, you know, we congratulations on the show. We heard you liked Rulers. So we've asked everyone in all of our branches to send you a ruler.
Oh, God.
And they pulled out this giant box.
Oh, fuck's
and there were about 400 rulers in there. But what? And each of the employees had sort of written a message on the ruler, like, good luck with the show, David. And but he said what made it sort of worse was that it turns out that most people in this company use the same.
Oh, God.
So it was 400 nearly identical.
It's mad. That is completely mad.
So
no one stood in and thought, shall we bother actually going this
he
far?
He said that, you know, they must have sort of, because these came from all over the world, they must have been FedExed over at great expense. So he did take it home. But at that point, he said he thought, this is it for the ruler collection.
Yeah.
You know, I'm gonna knock it on the head.
Until now when he's written about it.
Well, now he's written about it, but he ends by saying that now he's going to let it be known that he collects scissors.
Anything he actually wants to amass, yeah. Say he collects it and then he'll get it.
But I had a friend who I lived with at university who somehow it had became known that she really liked cows. And just for any birthday or present, she would get a sort of novelty cow-based item.
Did she get annoyed?
I think it became quite wearing after a while. I think, again, there was some truth in it. She did quite like cows. But at no point did she say, from now on, I only wish to receive objects in the shape of or in the colour scheme of a cow.
But the just more lack of imagination, yeah, isn't it, really?
Yeah. But yes, so David Shrigley and lots of other people contributed to this feature. And now you're going to hear a couple of those people in their own words tell you about their collections. We have the novelist Howard Jacobson talking about the Ministry of Public Buildings and Works leaflets that he collected as a teenager. We've got the historian Tom Holland talking about his hoard of Anglo-Saxon coins. And first you're going to hear the novelist Audrey Niffenegger, author of The Time Traveller's Wife and many other books, including some rather brilliant graphic novels, talking about how her life was changed by a close encounter with a taxidermied toad.
I grew up in a house full of collections. In 1977, when I was 14, my great aunt Dulcie died and my family inherited all her worldly goods. Since she had furnished her house in the 1930s and hardly ever got rid of a thing, we suddenly had a house full of odd things. I don't think she was a collector. She was simply someone who saved things in case they might come in handy. We had been antique shop junkies and thrifters before then, but Dulcie's stuff tipped us over some rational boundary, and we began to think of ourselves as collectors and of our possessions as collections. My dad once joked that any three things in our house could be a collection, and we all reacted with horror, because we knew if we bought into that notion, there would be no stopping us ever. When I was in art school, I happened to buy a taxidermied toad at a garage sale. It cost 25 cents and it was a bit broken. There were wires poking out where its hands should have been. It was overstuffed and clumsily sewn. I felt sorry for it, bought it, and took it home. A few years later, I bought a more elaborate piece of taxidermy, a mongoose with a cobra wrapped around its middle. The mongoose is biting the cobra, and the cobra is squeezing the mongoose, but since they are both dead, the joke is on both of them, alas. I later discovered that this particular tableau is a taxidermist's cliché, but when I was 23, it just seemed like black humor. I put it on a shelf above my bed, though my boyfriend found it an anti-aphrodisiac. The third piece of taxidermy, the one that doomed me, was a squirrel. It is an ordinary gray squirrel perched on a branch. It looks alarmed, but that is the normal expression of squirrels in cities. I once played a joke using this squirrel. My boyfriend liked to feed squirrels and had developed a cult following of squirrels who would wait around his door in hopes of a few almonds or cashews. He was beginning to worry that he'd over-encouraged them. One afternoon, I arrived at his house with my stuffed squirrel. I placed it on the driver's seat of his car and got on with the rest of the day, not mentioning this to my boyfriend. I heard no more of the matter for a week. Then he presented me with a photograph of my squirrel among all the live squirrels, all in the same pose, with the same expression, surrounded by nuts. "You nearly gave me a heart attack," he told me. Once there were three taxidermied animals in my apartment, my family understood this as a come-hither, and more taxidermy began to arrive on Christmas and birthdays without any further effort on my part. Now, our home is a sort of sad taxidermy refuge. I collect taxidermy that is unloved, missing bits, badly mounted, or just forlorn. I recently tried to put a stop to the accumulation, but I can feel the spirits of all the unacquired taxidermy standing anxiously at our front gate, wondering why they haven't been allowed to come in. I imagine my resolve will not last long.
I'm Tom Holland, a historian, and I am going to open a package for you live because I know what's in this package. A bit like an addict being sent his fix. I have been sent a coin by my dealer, a wonderful man called, fittingly enough, John Mann, who is just the nonpareil among people dealing in Anglo-Saxon coins, which is my particular obsession. It's become my particular obsession. In large part, it has to be said, because John feeds my habit. And he has sent me an amazing prize. I promised myself that I wasn't going to spend money that I haven't got. But this is... it's just too good to miss out on, because what I have here, and I open it up, bring it out very, very carefully, because these coins are very delicate. And even though it's been wrapped up very carefully, I don't want to damage it. It's just this very, very delicate kind of thin piece of silver. And what it shows is... it's a coin of Alfred the Great. And on one side, there is a portrait of Alfred, complete with his name, Alfred, and his title, Rex, King. And then on the other side, there is a monogram which includes letters from London. So it's a coin minted by Alfred in London, probably around 980. So very, very early in the process by which Wessex, the kingdom ruled by Alfred, was fused with Mercia, the kingdom to the north, and London was traditionally a Mercian city. So the fact that Alfred is minting this coin in London is indicative of the fact that he is laying claim to the rule of Mercia, a kingdom which had been conquered by the Vikings by terms of a peace treaty. Alfred has divided it in two and he's taken one half of it, but he's laying claim to London, ancient Roman capital, long in ruins, and been occupied by the Vikings. And what Alfred is doing with this coin is not just kind of laying claim to London itself, but he's laying claim to the idea of something incredibly important and momentous. He's laying claim to the idea that he, a Saxon, he's the king of Wessex, the West Saxons, is laying claim to the Anglian kingdom of Mercia. And so he's laying claim to an identity that is Anglo-Saxon. So what we have in this coin is a visual record of something that is unspeakably momentous, because essentially what we see here is kind of one of the birth certificates of England. And to touch it, to hold it, to own it is an incredible rush. And it's very, very beautiful apart from anything else. But its beauty, at least in part, is because it's such an astonishing thing actually to own. So there, I've got it. I'm now going to open up my treasure trove of other preciouses. I feel like Gollum, only with a whole collection of rings. I'm going to put it in there, push it back, put it in the coin case, lock it up, and feel a very happy bunny.
Howard Jacobson collecting. I was too half-hearted a child ever to be a real collector. I'd trade a cigarette packet for an autograph, and the autograph for a stamp, and the stamp for a marble, and then lose the marble. Only when it got competitive, as when I tried to build up a bigger list of books than my friend Gabriel, titles of books we'd read, then titles of books we owned, then titles of books we'd seen in bookshop windows, and finally, bizarrely, titles of books we'd simply heard of, did I feel anything of what I supposed a collector was meant to feel. But then an auntie took me on a coach trip to Furness Abbey, followed by a train trip to Knaresborough Castle. And there, at last, among the mossy stones and echoes of sieges and devotion, I discovered the true avidity to acquire. Not the ruins themselves, obviously, though I wouldn't have minded having what was left of Bolton Abbey in the back garden, but the descriptive leaflets published by the Ministry of Public Buildings and Works, available free or for a few pennies at the entrances to the sites. Their sober informativeness, in contrast to the picturesque ruination they chronicled, spoke at one and the same time to the romantic and the civil servant in me. I didn't mention my new enthusiasm for leaflets to Gabriel. They were too suggestive of windswept loneliness to share, and I liked the idea that not another boy on the planet was collecting them. Eventually, I grew dissatisfied with the pace at which my collection was growing. There were only so many day trips we could afford to take, and hit upon the ruse of sending stamped addressed envelopes to the Ministry of Public Buildings and Works, begging information on this or that pile of rubble for a school essay I was writing. A braver boy would have taken himself off to Tintern Abbey and Kirkham Priory, but it suited me to stay home and stare at the letterbox. Did I ever own them all? I suspect I came close. I arranged them alphabetically in box files and would choose one randomly to read at night. For a while, I was expert in the architecture of keeps and wells and cloisters. I gave up when I discovered that Gabriel had been secretly doing the same. He did have them all. I burnt mine in the garden. Not since the dissolution of the monasteries had there been such a conflagration.
So, Kate, as Love Island enters its final phase, you've picked a particularly apt nonversary, haven't you?
My own Love Island. 19 years ago, next week, 1999, Chris Tarrant's short-lived ITV show Man Oh Man came to an end. When I looked back to research Man Oh Man about 10 minutes ago, I didn't want to know too much about the concept behind it because in my mind there wasn't one.
Yeah.
So it was a swimming pool with some men arranged in front of it, all sorts of different shapes and sizes of men, relatively youngish, maybe under 30, looking as men did in the late 1990s. The audience was entirely full of women. They had keypads and they voted for who they would like to push into the swimming pool and who they would like to keep standing up on dry land. And the swimming pool pushers were done courtesy of a load of kind of supermodels, Miss World types in lovely dresses, or sometimes I feel like I remember them being in swimming costumes. And this music would play, which when I returned to it on YouTube is not the music I remember, kind of tiki music would play. And basically all the women in the audience would clap along in time to the music. And then the women would walk along and they would go up and down the line of men and then push one into the pool and then give another one a kiss and everyone would be like happy because that guy didn't get pushed into the water. And this ran for two seasons and people liked it.
If this was a pitch and you were pitching it's that to me as a TV studio exec, I would say that's on the flimsy side.
Yeah, it's been compared to a kind of an early Take Me Out, but I think even that's stretching it. There was kind of wailing live sax music on the clip I just watched now. And I think the men
weird
would...
Weird Aztec background as well.
Aztec, yes, always like going into the... Rainforest Cafe and Piccadilly
Circus.
Or the
zone in the Crystal Maze.
Or the Crystal Maze, yeah. Exactly. Loads of fiberglass everywhere. And I think that the men were required to do something to show... their prowess in different areas. Like sometimes they would do that thing where they have to like tweak their pecs and they move up and down to the music.
Yeah.
Like they take their shirts off and then their tits dance up and down. And then another one, there was a man who had to do a bit of river dance standing next to two real Irish dancers. But yeah, that was it. And I have no other information about it. But I would look it up on YouTube if I were you. Man, oh man.
It looks like a weird sort of performance, piece of performance art. I mean, I can imagine that playing on loop in a gallery, on a loop in a gallery somewhere.
Yeah.
The men look, I mean, everyone looks very 90s. Obviously, it is the 90s. But the men particularly, they're all wearing those, are they called granddad shirts?
Yeah.
Like with collarless shirts with like four buttons down there.
And they've got sort of slightly lank hair and curtains.
Lank curtains. And
it's very unreconstructed. I mean, Tarrant's intro on the bit I just watched now, he says, frankly, anything in trousers is at risk with this Amazon audience. And the Amazon audience is like the housewives clapping along.
Let's say it's a very different sort of ideal of beauty to Love Island.
It is, which makes me sad because I thought late 90s beauty was great.
Yeah, they're allowed to have like missing teeth and
yeah. Purer than Love Island. Yeah,
purer than
Man Love Island. Man, oh man. Happy 19th anniversary death day next week.
Thank you for downloading this episode of The Back Half. We will be back with you in 3 weeks rather than the usual 2 weeks.
Where are we going to be, Tom?
We're going to be on an island composed of plastic debris to celebrate the horrendous problems with plastic pollution.
So depressing. Where? I'm going to be in a treehouse in Austria.
Are you?
It has all the mod cons and two bedrooms, yeah.
Which are the mod cons?
A DVD player and a toilet.
Nice.
It's got those. Where will you be?
I'm going to be somewhere in the wilds of the west of Ireland. But we will be back with you in 3 weeks. In the meantime, please rate us on iTunes. Listen to our back catalogue. Listen to the other New Statesman podcasts. And most importantly, buy the summer double issue of the New Statesman, where you can read Kate's interview with League of Gentlemen, all our brilliant writers on their collections. What else have we got in our summer double issue?
Big roundup of good films, good TVs, and a surprising Q&A on the back page.
So in the meantime, we will leave you
with the scrote-stabbing tones of Godspeed by the wonderful Japanese band Pistol Jazz.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.